WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I might say that the reading is sponsored by both the English Department and the University Speakers Bureau. They've been nice enough to subsidize the reading, for which we are very grateful in the English Department. After having read The Rape of Lucrece in my sophomore year in high school, I regretted very much not having been able to have met William Shakespeare. I made a pilgrimage to Walden Pond in 1955 to see where it was that Thoreau almost clubbed the loon out in the pond, regretting, in fact, that I wasn't able finally to even identify the spot in which he had his cabin. And of course, the great regret of my life was not having met James Joyce. Nevertheless, I am indeed blessed to have the acquaintance of John Barth, the author of Sotweed Factor, Shamira, The End of the Road, Giles Goatboy, Floating Opera. What can I say, but I'd like to introduce the outstanding novelist of our time, John Barth.
That puts me in the position immediately of it's being an impossible act to follow. When you say you didn't get to meet Henry David Thoreau, you didn't get to meet James Joyce. I wish for you that you had met Thoreau and that you had met Joyce instead. It reminds me of what I tell my fiction writing students, that they should never use two of the rules. All the rules are rule number one, I tell them, and rule number one includes these two. That they should never use a title for their fiction which is a quotation from a better work than the one they've written. And that they should never begin a work of fiction with an epigraph, since it's likely to remind the readers of other writers whom they would be better spending their time reading than the one that they're reading. You should never, Zach, begin an introduction by saying, "I didn't get to meet James Joyce, but here's one." A year ago or so, one of the gods in my private pantheon is the old Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, and I'd met him a couple of times, but most recently he was in America for a year as officially resident writer at Michigan State, and we went out there as he flew up from Buenos Aires for a kind of homage to this marvelous old writer. He spoke in the afternoon, and it was brilliant and moving and monumental and the rest. And by an act of exquisitely bad timing, they had scheduled me to speak in the evening after Borges in the afternoon. And I thought, well, at least the only thing that will save me is Senor Borges is an old man, and he'll go to bed after dinner and won't be there for that reading. But he's not old in that sense, and he was delighted to come to the reading. He sat on the very first row, and though blind, he was looking right through me. And I had to begin my evening that evening by quoting from myself an essay that has risen up to haunt me since, called The Literature of Exhaustion, in which I spoke of great writers such as Nabokov, Borges, and Beckett, who are now in the evenings of their careers. Borges had spoken in the afternoon. There I was in the evening trying to do it. Well, good evening. For reasons that will become clearer and clearer as we go along, I'm going to cast my introductory remarks, the written ones, in the form of a letter headed Newark, Delaware, October, 27, 1977, and addressed to dear readers whom it may or may not concern, whom I hope it will concern. Here's the letter. Dear readers, etc., etc. For reasons that will become clearer and clearer as we go along, I am writing this letter to explain to you a 5-year silence. Why you've not heard from me since 1972, when my last book was published, a book of novellas called Chimera. Here's the story. It's that 3 years before that, in 1969, which I think was when was about when I last visited the University of Delaware, as a matter of fact, it was my fate to be awarded my maiden honorary degree. I hadn't a PhD of my own, an honest one, and I was delighted to pass this actuarial milestone in everyone's career, to be awarded my maiden honorary degree. It was a doctorate in letters from the University of Maryland, which appealed not only to my vanity, since I didn't have an honest PhD, but specifically to my sense of plot. In fact, it played right into my hands that the author of the fiction that I was already then engaged in 1969 and am still engaged in, and which I mean to talk about and illustrate for you for a while tonight, that the author of that fiction should be a bona fide doctor of letters. Think of that term, for example, in the medical sense. I wasn't then at Johns Hopkins as I am now, but I was thinking of returning there, where a university which everyone mistakes for a medical school anyway and calls by the wrong name, leaving the S off of Johns Hopkins. I don't blame them for that. It's a curious name. I wouldn't name any son of mine Johns. Think of the term doctor of letters in the John Hopkins sense of it. Literature may not be terminally ill, as Professor McLuhan and his colleagues in the 1960s liked to frighten us by supposing that it might be, but on the other hand, she's not as young as she used to be either. It was my concern for the ongoing health of prose fiction that had led me in the middle 1960s, while at the State University of New York at Buffalo, to experiment with narratives for electronic tape and live voice, the oral tradition from which printed literature sprang. It's my fate to be an opposite sex twin, and whatever the other virtues and vices are, liabilities and assets of being an opposite sex twin, I completely agree with one psychiatrist who had the bad judgment to send me a monograph he'd written on the psychological profile of opposite sex twins. One of their distinguishing characteristics, it turns out, is a conspicuous tendency toward regression, toward regressiveness. It rang true immediately for me. Why not? You know, it's not only that we knew as a biological fact what Aristophanes only speculates on, that we're all the fallen halves of a once complete whole, but unlike you other guys, we had company in the womb. There were friends in there. We liked it. Why shouldn't everything be a bit of a bring down after that? And why shouldn't we, as a species, tend towards regressiveness? I'm sure that accounted for my interest in going back to the oral tradition in the 60s to see how my earliest ambition was not to be a writer, but to be a musician, and not specifically in that category to be either a performer or a composer, but to be what in those days, of the 1940s, we used to be called the big band days, we used to call an arranger, an orchestrator. It's always been a tendency of mine, I think, in literature too, to be happier reorchestrating some old convention, going back, if not to the womb, at least to some earlier stage of the conventions we practice, seeing how they might be reorchestrated for present purposes. And that same concern with the oral tradition, a concern which, being a good Hopkins medical type, I confess was more exploratory than therapeutic, led me to the present very different project, which has nothing to do with oral narrative at all. It pleased me, too, for reasons that et cetera, to regard myself as a doctorer of letters, a doctor in that other sense, a doctorer of letters in the secret police sense of the word. I don't by any means agree with everything that Gore Vidal says about literature, certainly not with his judgment of my own writings, but But I'm delighted by a supposition that he made in an essay somewhere or other some years ago, that the secret diaries, both of Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin of President Kennedy, and of Arthur Bremer, the would-be assassin of then-Governor Wallace of Alabama, were both the work, the literary production of E. Howard Hunt, who, as you may know, wrote a great many novels. What Vidal did was a kind of tongue-in-cheek or half-in-cheek stylistic analysis of E. Howard Hunt's collected fiction and then applied it to the literary style of these two journals of assassins and found that they had a great deal in common. And he supposes, well, at least I agree with Vidal's, by his casual assertion, that it's been one of the chief functions of secret police in every country and time that we know anything about, as long as there's been writing, certainly, to forge and falsify not only the documents of history, but particularly when those communications were written communications, the communications between people. Well, what I've been up to all these years is a book-length fiction, more of a novel than not, which, I blush to report, is in one of the oldest and the most vulnerable of English novel forms, the epistolary novel. The novel, this is, you know, the novel in letters, a genre made so popular by Samuel Richardson. It was the first real pop genre of the novel, as those of you know who know something about the history of literature. It was made so popular by Samuel Richardson in the second quarter of the 18th century that it was already worked to death by the fourth quarter of the 18th century. The jury may still be out on the general question of the death of the novel, but if there's any species of the genus that everybody agrees died an early death, and justly so, it's the epistolary novel. But I take it as part of my function as a doctor of letters, an official doctor of letters, to administer artificial resuscitation to the apparently dead. And so the title of this novel, I hope you can see my table here. I brought my visual impediments with me. The title of this novel is Letters. It consists of letters, that is, epistles, letters in that sense of the word, letters between several correspondents, and it's preoccupied, among other things, with the role of epistles, real letters, forged letters, doctored letters, mislaid and misdirected letters, in the history of history, also in the history of the dramatic arts. It's impossible to imagine a Renaissance drama or Italian grand opera, for example, without the wonderful device of the mislaid letter or the letter that somehow falls into the wrong hands, etc. I like that sort of conventions. It's also concerned with this book, and of course it's constituted of alphabetical letters, the atoms of which the universe of print is made. Finally, I don't know whether it affects you or not, but it touches me, it strikes me sometimes that these experiences, the great books which have turned our lives around corners, which have shaken us to the heart or the soul, or amused us to tears or what have you, are finally reducible to combinations and permutations of a very small number of little squiggles on the page. Perhaps as you just get older in the medium, that fact impresses you more and more, one hopes fruitfully. Finally, to some extent, the book's addressed to the phenomenon of literature itself, the third main sense of our English word letters, literature which one film nut I know of has been quoted as calling, quote, that mildly interesting historical phenomenon of no present importance, end of quote. We don't go along with that kind of apocalyptic notion about literature in the 70s, as some of us did in the 60s, but one still has that sense, if only perversely, of that if you couldn't be there at the beginning of the genre, there is a kind of frisson at the idea of maybe being there at the end, if you couldn't write the... For one thing, I like the fact that the history of technology teaches over and over again that the most enormous, if not the best, productions in technology always come just after that technology has been made obsolete, so that you get, you know, the seven-masted sailing ships just at the point where the steamship has already made all sailing ships hors de combat, and those great big artillery pieces, the Big Bertha cannons that are forged just before ordnance or just after ordnance has taken a radically different turn. I don't believe that about literature, but I like to frighten myself a bit. with that possibility. What else? Letters is a seven-letter word. Letters is my seventh book of fiction, as it happens. The letters in Letters are from seven correspondents, some of them recruited from the earlier stories. That's a sign, my wife tells me, a sure sign that a writer has passed 40 when he begins to recycle characters from his early inventions. And she makes me promise, and it's a promise I'll honor, that one needn't have either read or heard of the earlier books in order to be entertained by the present one. These letters are dated over the 7 months from March through September 1969. I've forgotten exactly why at this remove, though they also involve the 1976 U.S. bicentennial, which in 1969 was a certain number of years off. The War of 1812, my personal favorite among American belligerences, it's the war in which the term hawks and doves was coined in the Congress. It's a war that, as it happens, extra literarily and accidentally, happens to have been fought along my personal biographical axis. That is, its two main theaters were the Chesapeake Bay Area and the Niagara frontier. Never mind that. It also touches upon or looks at the American Revolution, but only because it looks at revolutions and recyclings, not political ones especially, but recyclings and reenactments, generally. Reenactments, I guess, is the bottom line there. There are to be 88 of these letters in all, and since I have, as of this hour, drafted about 67 of them, I'm somewhere near 6/7 of the way done with this project, serene in the knowledge that the first 6/7 of any project are no doubt the most difficult, and that from there on, it's easy sailing. The curse and the blessing, I suppose, of being a writer of a formalistic bent is that you always know where you are. And that can be either good news or bad news, depending on how much there is to go. By 1968, such an immeasurably long time ago, I knew at least one other detail about the project, namely that at a point precisely 6/7 of the way through it, if I ever got there, there should occur two stories within the main story, one about the Greek mythic hero Perseus and his friend Medusa, to be written by a character named Ambrose Mensch, who, as it happens, is borrowed from a series of stories of mine called Lost in the Funhouse, but never mind that, and who is also one of the correspondents in the Letters book. Another classical mythological story about the minor Greek hero Bellerophon and his adversary, the original Chimera, that three-part monstrous fiction or fictive monster, whichever, to be written by a fellow named Jerome Bonaparte Bray, of whom more later, another of our correspondents and the putative editor of a book of mine called Giles Goatboy. I decided that I would do those two little inside texts first, that I would start not in medias res, as the classical writers did, but 6/7 of the way through, however that comes out in Latin, and let the novel sort of accrete around it. What happened was that those two little texts grew into something larger, the book called Chimera, which consists of three more or less related novellas, and therefore, in a way that may bore you to tears, but interests us doctors of letters sufficiently, this book, these beautiful novellas, are in a particular way contaminated from the future by the project that was supposed to have given them birth. I don't know what to make of that vertiginous state of affairs, except to confess it and hope for some kind of absolution. The fact is that we fiction writers, particularly we novelists, practice a very impure art, and if we don't learn to relish those contaminations, we're probably in trouble. As teachers, we always try to explain that everything in the work that we're teaching is splendidly and lucidly self-sufficient. That is, that it's called for, it's made inevitable by the text. In fact, God knows, as in opera, this aria is in there for the tenor because it was left over from the opera you wrote before, and your impresario is saying, look, the tenor has to have a good aria, and you shark it up. I used to try to explain, and I thought did very ingeniously in my early days as a teacher, the constant striking of clocks in Kafka's fiction, the ticking and striking of clocks, and I would explain it symbolically 15 different ways until someone told me that they'd been to visit Kafka's family apartment in Prague, and the fact is there was a church or something next door where the goddamn clock was always ticking and banging, and Kafka simply couldn't keep it out, I suppose, of the fiction. Well, if we had time enough, I would read you some examples of the contamination. I won't do that, and instead go right to the contaminator and read you now two little sample specimens from this work, So Long in Progress. Here is, to begin with, part of the text of the first of the 88 letters in this novel, Letters, and therefore the opening of the book. It's letter A from part L of this septpartite fiction. Its author is not from any previous fictions of mine. Her name is Germaine Gordon Pitt, Lady Amherst. She's an admirable, widowed, middle-aged English gentlewoman and scholar in reduced circumstances who traces her descent. For those of us who've spent most of our professional literary careers being irrealists or anti-realists, there's something erotically exciting about trying to describe a person, to invent one, a recognizable person like this one sitting in front of me here. Would you stand that person up for a minute so that we can... Germaine Gordon Pitt, Lady Amherst, is an admirable, widowed, middle-aged English gentlewoman and scholar in reduced circumstances who traces her descent from an unrecorded dalliance in London or in Switzerland between the aging Madame de Staël and her young friend Lord Byron. Now, it's true that de Staël, in her latter years, de Staël didn't live very long. She's, you know, the figure who, in the pre-Napoleonic directory, and then in the Napoleonic era, who also was a famous novelist and wrote a couple of epistolary novels, as a matter of fact, and was one of the introducers of German Romanticism into France. Never mind that. She knew Byron. She met him at the end of her life. She died early, dropsical and a junkie, from too much laudanum. And knew Byron in Switzerland when Byron was young and of course a sexual snob, and there's no possible way that, no, it's impossible that they could have got together. But my Lady Amherst, in any case, traces her descent from this unrecorded and certainly unlikely dalliance, also from Lord Geoffrey Amherst, Commander-in-Chief of British Forces in America during the French and Indian Wars, Lord Jeff, to whom, you know, goes the accolade not of being the person who introduced bacteriological warfare to the North American continent. That honor goes to one of his lieutenants, a professional soldier named Lieutenant Ecuyer, who was the commandant of Fort Pitt during the siege in the course of Pontiac's conspiracy. And it was Lieutenant Ecuyer, a Swiss mercenary soldier, who proposed in a famous letter to Lord Amherst that we warm the Indians during the winter who are besieging our fort with infected blankets from the smallpox hospital. And also, in the same letter, he requests hunting dogs to set upon the squaws and children. Lord Amherst, in a famous letter, Lord Amherst approved the first idea and passed the word along to other of his commanding officers. He liked that notion all right, but in the same letter, he rejects the second idea on the grounds that the only good hunting dogs, the kennels are in England, and that the dogs would probably suffer from the transatlantic passage, so he vetoed it. Lady Amherst, who lives in the present, 1969, the present of this novel, is perhaps the central character of the story, and she's the author of 24 of the 88 letters. Here's the first. It's letter A. It's on the letterhead of the Office of the Provost, Faculty of Letters, Tidewater Hall, Marshy Hope State University, Red Man's Neck, Maryland, 21612. It's dated 8 March 1969. It's addressed to Mr. John Barth, Esquire, care of Random House Incorporated Publishers, 201 East 50th Street, New York, New York, 10017. I don't recount. I only invent. The work is a work of fiction made of the whole cloth. I've never met a Lady Amherst. I wish there were such a person. I hope that if life imitates art, or if, as my experience has been, art turns out to be banal prophecy, that my novel will bring into existence such a woman as Lady Amherst, whom I admire enormously, if only because I made her up. Random House was not my publisher at 8 March 1969. They didn't become so till later. This is a letter. The whole notion of drawing characters from life appalls me. The phrase even suggests to me a kind of medieval form of capital punishment where you take somebody and draw them to the gallows, etc. But I do admire a remark of Nabokov's in an interview that he gave some years before his death, may he rest in peace, that he too deplores any kind of biographical, not to say autobiographical fiction, but that upon occasion he will bestow on one of his characters a detail from his own life as one might award a medal. I like that. This letter is apparently dictated to a secretary to whom Lady Amherst has trouble. It's an American secretary, and she has trouble getting her to do British spelling and British punctuation. Dear Mr. Barth, : at the end of the current semester, Marshy Hope State University will complete the seventh academic year since its founding in 1962 as Tidewater Technical College, new sentence. In that short time, we have grown from a private vocational hyphen training school with an initial enrollment of 13 students, through annexation as a four-hyphen-year college in the state university system, to our present status, effective a month hence, at the beginning of the next fiscal year, as a full-hyphen-fledged university center with a projected population of 50,000 by 1976. New paragraph, and I'll drop the punctuation now because it's too burdensome a device out loud, but you must hear the punctuation as we go along. To mark this new elevation, at our June commencement ceremonies, we shall exercise for the first time one of its perquisites, the awarding of honorary degrees. Specifically, we shall confer one honorary doctorate in each of law, letters, and science. It is my privilege, on behalf of the faculty, acting President Schott, and the Board of Regents of the State University, to invite you to be with us at 10 a.m. Saturday, 21 June 1969, in order that we may confer upon you the degree of Doctor of Letters, honoris causa, in recognition of your contributions to the life of literature, new paragraph. Sincerely hopeful that you will honor us by accepting the highest distinction that Marshy Hope can confer, and looking forward to a favorable reply, I am, yours sincerely, Jermaine G. Pitt, parenthesis, Amherst, close parenthesis, acting provost. There's a subscript on the letter, uppercase GGP, parenthesis, A, parenthesis, / lowercase SS, apparently the initials of her secretary. There is a postscript to the letter. And the postscript, you must imagine, is being written in longhand and not dictated, Lady Amherst's longhand, though I think it would be a tacky device to reproduce longhand on the page. You are to imagine this as being now confidential and in longhand. P.S. A red letter day on my personal calendar, this. The first in too long, dear Mr. B, but never mind that, and do forgive both this presumptuous postscriptum and my penmanship. Some things I can't entrust to my good right hand, soi-disant of a secretary, a hand dependent, I have reason to suspect, more from the arm of our esteemed acting president than from my arm, on which she'd like nothing better, if I have your American slang aright, than to put the finger, and so must pen, as it were, with my left, quite as I've been obliged by fate and history, my own, England's, Western cultures, to swallow pride and... New paragraph. But see how in the initial sentence, my initial sentence, I transgress my vow not to go on about myself like those dotty women of a certain age who burden the patience of novelists and doctors, their circumstantial ramblings, all reducible, I dare say, to one cri de coeur, help, love me, I grow old. Already you cluck your tongue, dear Mr. B, whom I do not know, if indeed you've read me even so far. Life is too short, you say, to suffer fools and frustrates, especially of the prolix variety. Yet it is you, sir, who, all innocent, provoke this stammering postscript. I've got to interrupt Lady Amherst's postscript here for a minute to say that while it may or may not be true that in life coming events cast their shadows before them in honestly made fiction they always do. She doesn't know it yet, this wonderful woman verging upon 50, but a few chapters later in the novel, she's going to find herself astonishingly, embarrassingly, exhilaratingly, impossibly pregnant at age 50, not by the addressee, but of the letter, but by another character in the novel. And though she doesn't know it, can't know it yet, somehow that possibility seems telonomically to be introducing itself in this. Okay, we go on. Nothing else than the report of your impatience with just this sort of letters conceived my vow to make known my business to you, tout de suite sans préambule, sans divagation, and nothing other than that vow effected, so to speak, its own aborting, nay, contraception, so perverse, so helpless the human heart. And yet bear on, I pray. I am what I am, rather what I find to my own dismay I am become. I was not always so. Old school marm rendered fatuous by loneliness, indignified by stillborn dreams, I prate like a co-ed on her first date, and this to a man not merely my junior, but no matter. I will be brief. I will be frank. Mr. B., but for the opening paragraphs of your recentest, which lies before me, I know your writings only at second hand. For one thing, I came to your country, as did your novels to mine, not very long since, and neither visitor, to their credit be it said, sojourns heart on sleeve. A great good friend of mine, himself a Nobel laureate in literature, once declared to me, when I asked him why he would not read his contemporaries, new paragraph. Mais Germaine, Germaine, tu n'es pas Germaine, as my ancestor and namesake, Madame de Staël, must often have cried to herself. I can do no better than to re-begin with one of her own charming ouvertures, and I quote, "Forgive me this too long letter. I had not time to write a short." I wish I had written that line, my friends. It's a line from it's the opening of one of Madame de Staël's marvelous letters. It reminds me of a remark a fiction student of mine made when he gave me a manuscript saying, "I think this is going to be part of a shorter work." Forgive me this too long letter. I had not time to write a short. To business. Cher Monsieur B., is it French or Deutschisch, Schweizerisch, that name? From the lieutenant who led against the Bastille in Grand, 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 Grand Mayor's Day, or the late theologian of our own? Either way, sir, we are half countrymen, even though for all you came to light in Maryland's Dorset, she means Dorchester County over in Maryland, and I in England's Dorset. May this hors d'oeuvre keep your appetite for the entree while I make short work of soup and salad. Lady Amherst is Swiss, and I guess she's forgotten for the moment that the French would normally serve the salad after the entree. Not sure. Salad of laurels, sir. Sybil greens, Daphne's death leaves. Honorific if worn lightly, fatal if swallowed. I seriously pray you will take it, this highest honor that marshy hope can bestow. I pray you will not take it seriously. Oh, this sink, this slough, this eastern shore of Maryland, this marshy county Dorchester, whence to be sure you sprang, mallow from the marsh, as inter faeces, etc., we are born all. Do please forgive whom? How should you've heard of me, who've not read you, and yet nominated you for the MU Lit D? I have exposed myself already, then let me introduce me, Germaine Pitt, I, nay Gordon, Lady Amherst, late of that other Dorset, I mean Hardy's, and sweeter Cambridge, now, quote, distinguished visiting lecturer in English, end of quote, to my ear the only resident speaker of that tongue, and acting provost of make-believe university's factory of letters, as my late good friend might have put it, a university not so much pretentious as pretending, a toadstool blown overnight from this ordurous swamp to broadcast doctorates like spores before our stationer can amend the letterhead. I shall not tire you with the procession of misfortunes which, since the end of the Second War, has fetched me from the ancestral seats of the Gordons and the Amhersts, where 300 years ago is reckoned as but the day before yesterday, and the 17th century Earls of Dorset are gossiped of as if still living, to this misnamed shear, she still means Dorchester County in Maryland, this misnamed shear, which sets about the celebration this July of its tercentenary as if 1669 were classical antiquity. Nor shall I tire you with my passage from the friendship, more than friendship, of several of the greatest novelists of our century to the supervisal of their desecration in modern novel 101-102. A decline the sadder for its paralleling that of the genre itself, perhaps, God forfend, of literature as a whole, perhaps even of the precious word. These adversities I bear with what courage I can draw from the example of my favorite forebear, who, she still means Madame de Stael, who, harassed by Napoleon, abused by her lovers, nevertheless maintained to the end that generosity of spirit and brilliance of wit which make her letters my solace and inspiration. But in the matter of the honorary doctorate, and my blind insistence upon your nomination, therefore, I must speak to you with a candor which, between a master of arts and their lifelong mistress, I must trust not to miscarry, for I cannot imagine your regarding a distinction so wretched on the face of it, otherwise than with amused contempt. And yet upon your decision to accept or decline ride matters of some, and it may be more than local, consequence. Briefly. Now I'm going to start summarizing and skipping because her letter goes on and on. Briefly, the tiny history of redneck tech has been a 7-year battle between the most conservative elements in the state, principally local, for as you know, Mason's and Dixon's line may be said to run north and south in Maryland, up Chesapeake Bay, and the eastern shore is more southern than Virginia, and the most liberal elements, who in higher latitudes would be judged cautious moderates at best. Now this is exposition, so it's not going to sound good out loud, but I'll skim it and summarize it. The original college was endowed by a local philanthropist, now deceased, an excellent gentleman whose fortune, mirabile dictu, derived from pickles, and whose politics were so Tory that, going quite crackers in his final years, he fancied himself to be not Napoleon, but, rest their souls, George III, still fighting the American Revolution as his saner neighbors still refight your Civil War. This chap, whose name is Harrison Mack II, is afflicted with this madness as described, which as it grows more severe and terminal, grows as it were more accurate, so that from imagining himself George III sane, he comes to imagine himself George III mad, and then in the terminal phases of his own madness, imagines himself a George III mad who in his madness imagines himself Harrison Mack sane, and therefore is able to conduct his business with his usual acumen, and wonders why his household is going about in pre-regency get up. George III mad, as you may know, did a few interesting things in the later stages of his madness, among them getting interested in novels for the first time in his life, and had his daughters and others read him Fielding's works, then set about to make a long series of notes, which I'd love to see, and if I were a scholar, would look up on King Lear and on Don Quixote. Those must be great notes indeed that mad George III made on mad Lear and on mad Quixote. His Majesty's Board of Trustees it was who pressed most vigorously to bring the college under state administration in the first place, hoping thereby to rescue it from parochial reaction. And the president of the college during those first stages of its history was a man of reasonably liberal opinions, their appointee, the historian Joseph Morgan. To console the Tories, however, one John Schott, formerly head of a nearby teacher's college and a locally famous right-winger, was appointed provost of the Faculty of Letters and vice president of what was now awkwardly denominated Marshy Hope State University College. A power struggle ensued at once, for Dr. Schott's as politically ambitious as he's ideologically conservative. He had foreseen correctly that MSUC was destined for gigantic expansion, and he'd sensed, again correctly, opportunity in the local resentment against its liberal administration. I skip. The wonder is that Morgan survived for even a few semesters in the face of his harassment, especially when his critics found their sweet singer in the person of one Andrew Burlingame Cook VI, self-styled laureate of Maryland, of whom, alas, more later, I dare say you know of that formidable charlatan and his mind-abrading doggerel, e.g., Fight Marylanders, Nail and Tooth for John Schott and his Tower of Truth, etc. Which same tower, presently under construction, was the gentle Morgan's undoing? Now, she goes on, Lady Amherst, to explain in relentless detail a power struggle between this President Morgan on the one hand and this Vice President Schott and A.B. Cook VI on the other. Schott's political ambitions, it seems, extend across Chesapeake Bay to, quote, Annapolis, maybe even Washington, end of quote. A.B. Cook, she believes, to be a sinister figure behind his buffoonery, a maker and unmaker of kingmakers, a power behind the powers behind the throne. Morgan wants a kind of modest 7,000 student research institution. The Schott Cook faction wants to, and I go back to the text, build on Red Man's Neck a veritable city of learning, more populous and prosperous by far than any of the peninsula's actual municipalities, and from its center let there rise, as a symbol and advertisement of the whole, Marshy Hope's beacon to the world, a great white tower, the Tower of Truth. How were the fenny origins invoked of Rome? How learning was rhymed with yearning? Tower of Truth with flower of youth. Cook's rhetoric, all this, sweetly resounding in our chambers of commerce, where too there were whispered libels against the luckless Morgan, that his late wife had died a dozen years past, in circumstances never satisfactorily explained, etc., etc. By 1967, when Morgan acquiesced to that Tower of Truth in hopes of saving his plan for a manageable high-quality research center, the damage to his reputation had been done by locker room couplets of unacknowledged but unmistakable authorship, e.g., here is the late Mrs. Morgan interred, whose ménage à trois is reduced by one-third. Her husband and lover survive her, both fired, requiescat in pacem, the child they both sired, etc. Lady Amherst goes on in more prolix detail to explain the politics then of the honorary doctorate of letters. Cook's to be given the thing in recompense for his political services to acting President Schott, but by some complex wheeling and dealing between the opposing parties on the ad hoc nominating committee, a compromise is arrived at, and Lady Amherst ends this very, very long postscript many pages later by saying, you are then, sir, by way of being a compromise candidate, who will, I hope, so far from feeling therein compromised, come to the aid of your friend, they have a mutual friend, Ambrose Mensch, on this ad hoc committee, come to the aid of your friend, your native county, and its, quote, largest single economic and only cultural entity, end of quote, by accepting this curious invitation. Moreover, by accepting it promptly, before the opposition, some degree of which has to be expected, has time to rally. That Schott even tentatively permits this invitation implies that A.B. Cook VI has been sounded out and, for whatever mysterious reasons of his own, chooses not to exercise his veto out of hand. But our mutual friend Ambrose Mensch informs me grimly that there is a Dr. Schott in some early fiction of yours, too closely resembling ours, for coincidence and not flatteringly drawn. Should he get wind of this fact, can it be true? Too delicious. Before your acceptance has been made public, ... new paragraph. Au revoir, then, friend of my friend. I hold your first novel in my hand, eager to embark upon it. In your own hand, you may well hold some measure of our future here. Do therefore respond at your earliest to this passing odd epistle, whose tail, like the spermatozoan's, far outmeasures its body, the better to accomplish its single urgent end, And, like Joyce's Molly Bloom at the end of her great soliloquy, whose author was, yes, a friend of your friend's friend, say to us yes, to the Lit D, yes, to MSU, yes, and yes, Dorchester, yes, Tidewater, Maryland, yes, 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 yours, GGPA, parenthesis A, thank you. Thank you. Now, that letter, which is an academic letter dictated and then postscribed in particular circumstances, would give you a terribly misleading sense of the novel and what it's up to, since it's not an academic novel and it's not written in that. It even gives you a misleading sense, unfortunately, of Lady Amherst, who becomes a more formidable and less foolish character by far, I hope, at least it's my intention, as the action proceeds. This imaginary invitation, so I've tried to read a kind of counter letter now. This imaginary invitation, as it happens, is politely declined by the addressee, who moreover does not reply to the subsequent 23 long letters written him by Lady Amherst, a lady I would certainly be nicer to if she existed in real life. But the shtick of the novel is that she carries the burden of the plot, the reporting of the plot in weekly letters which go unanswered. Now, every book, Borges, that Argentine writer I invoked earlier, every book Borges says implies its counterbook, which I suppose ought ideally to be written by the author's anti-type. The author of the letters novel, whatever his lapses, is a human animal of legally sane mind and clinically sound body, and therefore the letters novel contains a chap named Jerome Bonaparte Bray of Lilydale, New York, the spiritualist capital of America, near Lake Chautauqua in western New York. Lake Chautauqua is where my wife and I spend our summers. There is a place nearby called Lilydale, which some of you may have heard of. It is the spiritualist capital of America. Every summer, spiritualists come up the flyway and congregate in Lilydale, and the vibrations, believe me, as you drive by in the car, it's enough to change your odometer. There 100 or 200 spiritualists gather, and they spirit all summer long. Bray is the putative editor of a novel of mine called Giles Goatboy, and he's possibly the author of a novella in the Chimera series called Bellerophoniad. I want you to listen to this carefully, my friends, because I've read this piece two times before this letter, once last spring at the University of Oregon, at Oregon State in Corvallis, at a convention a symposium about frauds, charlatans, and con men. And I joined the convention in order to, the symposium, to read this piece, which is about a certain kind of imitation or mimicry, let's say. And Peter Prescott, who reported on the conference later in Newsweek magazine, said of my reading that while it was perhaps entertaining and energetic, nobody in the audience understood a single word of what he was saying. I think that was not only an insult to the good people of Corvallis, who were more attentive than that, but to any audience who pays attention. Now listen, pay attention. This is out of the middle of a novel, and so some of it's a little cut, but I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on so that you won't miss any of the fun of it, if it's fun. I hope it'll turn out to be that way. You understand now who this Bray is and where he claims to be descended from. As best Bellerophon in that other novella, which never mind, can make out from certain letters he receives from the future, this guy Bray, in 1969 or earlier, is programming an obsolete computer. I'm not very interested in contemporary computer science, though I have a son in artificial intelligence at MIT who keeps me, perhaps because I have a son in that field, who keeps me briefed on the really amazing new software and so forth. But I like the old ones, the ones with the vacuum tubes and the cobwebs and the big fans and so forth and all the heat discharge. This Bray is programming an obsolete computer called LilyVac 2 to construct either a revolutionary novel or a novel revolution. One isn't sure which. In 1969, in the Letters novel, Bray and his girlfriend, or a female companion who's helping him, are still at it, but something has gone wrong. There's a glitch in the program or in the machine. At the climactic first trial printout, 3 years into a five-year plan, codenamed Novel, one letter for each year of the plan, codenamed novel 3 years into it, that is in year V, on St. Elric's Day. St. Elric, the patron saint, whom I invented, the patron saint of anagrammatists and Scrabble players. On St. Elric's Day, Lilivac 2, in this climactic first trial printout, has produced neither a novel nor a revolution, but astonishingly, an enormous jumble of numbers. In time, in my novel, Mr. Bray will decide that what he has on his hands is a great opus to be called Numbers, the first specimen of a revolutionary new medium called numerature, and that therefore his 5-year plan must be extended to 7 years, culminating in 1976. But given his literary bias, Bray starts, after all, as a word man, given his literary bias, Bray considers first whether this huge printout of numbers mightn't be some sort of ciphered verbal message. Okay, we're straight so far, right? There's this big printout. It's all numbers. And one of the oldest conventions in literature, certainly in American literature, is the note, and which comes simply from our literary bias, I'm sure, is that anything like that must be a message. It must be a coded message. I love the convention which goes back through Poe to God knows where of the message which you first have to crack. And then having cracked the code and deciphered the message, you find that the translated message is just as enigmatic and cryptic as the one you start out with all these typographical symbols in the gold bug, for example, and then when you've translated, all it reads is some gibberish like in the devil's seat on the second something or other, do this. In other words, you have to decode the message after you've decoded the message. Well, okay, you've got that. Bray's third letter, well into the novel, reflects this uncertainty of his. Is it a message to be deciphered or not, as well as some glitches apparently in his personal life. Our own uncertainty is compounded by the possibility that Lilivac 2 itself may be authoring or editing Bray's letters. I like, as I said, old conventions. If there was ever an instant cliche in American fiction and imagination, it's the cliche of the threatening and dominating computer who somehow takes over the scene. I thought of that long before whoever that movie maker is who made the movie where a computer gets to... Who is it? Julie Christie, right? And fertilizer. But even when I invented it, even if nobody thought of it before that, as I'm sure they had, it was an instant cliche. So one likes to reorchestrate that sort of cliche. All right. For example, when this computer comes upon a repeated phrase, either from the letter in hand or from some earlier of its letters, what it tends to do is reset and then recommence another sentence. Finally, there's the unpleasant possibility that Mr. Bray is not a human being at all, not even an anthropoid, but some man, and certainly not one of those bionic creatures that wander around network TV, but some manner of enormous bug, a kind of enormous insect with an extraordinary, though imperfect, capacity for mimicry, even for mimesis. My own supposition is that if nature were ever bountiful enough to give us a mutant bug in the form of a fiction writer, that fiction writer would probably write realistic novels, no doubt epistolary ones. Here is letter S from part T, the first T, letter S from the first T of letters. It's on the letterhead of Jerome Bonaparte Bray, General Delivery, Lilydale, New York, 14752. It's dated May 13, 1969, though the events it describes happened about a month earlier at the beginning of April. It's addressed to a fellow named Andrews F. Mack, care of the Tidewater Foundation, Marshy Hope State University, Red Man's Neck, Maryland, 21612. This is the radicalized son of the Tory philanthropist mentioned before. When Bray, and the letter is an appeal for money, when Bray would solicit the father, he would address him as Your Majesty or Your Royal Highness. When he addresses the son, he addresses him, Comrade. St. Elric, patron of cipherers, smile upon you as upon yours truly. Death to Jacobins, usurpers, anti-Bonapartists. The king is dead, long live the second revolution. Down with the pesticide cartel. Excuse my long hand, may we together reset. Our spring work period here at Lilydale is at its peak. LilyVac 2 is online and programmed to capacity. My comrade associate, Ms. LeFay, a.k.a. Merope Bernstein, she'll come in later, a.k.a. Merope Bernstein, see below, ditto, at our new base in Chautauqua, things are buzzing, buzzing. I must scratch out this report by hand. No time for epistolary printouts, but you would be surprised what LilyVac can reset. We last met in February at the funeral of H.R.H., His Royal Highness, Your Highness, Your Father, HM2G3RIP, when you questioned me closely as to the practicality of LilyVac's novel revolutionary program, RN, that is the revolutionary novel, for which you had twice loyally arranged support from the Tidewater Foundation. At one point, you even declared straight out your suspicion that it and I were pure humbird. I do not doubt that you were distracted by your grief. I myself am an orphan, have never known my dear parents, was raised in the backwater wildlife refuge and reset. As for me, I could scarcely have responded properly to your unexpected, though perfectly justified, interrogation. It was the last but one and deepest month of my winter rest period, snug as a bag in a rug, offline and dreaming of the revolutionary title notes read out by LilyVac at the midpoint of year V, a.k.a. T, a.k.a. 122168 Vide Infra. I could have been roused at all by nothing less momentous than the death of your father, the most trusted, the most recent. This letter is to allay your skepticism, to report to you personally, as we can no longer trust the Tidewater Foundation per se, the setbacks and successes of our spring work period, and to warn you against the aforementioned Tidewater Foundation executive director, he shall reset. On Tuesday, March 4, Feast of Purim, full warm moon, I authorize said A, he means a chap named Todd Andrews is a lawyer for the Tidewater Foundation, I authorize said A to institute plagiarism proceedings as part of our general campaign to neutralize anti-Bonapartist counter-revolutionaries, no reply. On April 1, St. Elrit's Day, on the eve of LilyVac's first trial printout of the revolutionary novel Notes, I took time to write him again, confiding the results of our fall work period and our hopes for the spring, e.g., our initial concern at LilyVac's entitling the project, not novel, but notes, our wondering, therefore, whether we were in year T rather than in year V, C, reset. In the same letter, I urged him to reply to mine of 3/4 and move against B, whom also I rewarned to make reparations to me by 6:13 p.m. P.S. T44, 6:13 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, April 4, 1969, was prophesied by some chap, of course, in California, to be doomsday. Didn't work out that way. To make reparation by 6:13 p.m. PST 44 or reset. No reset. We're going to have to reprogram LilyVac, not to reset. That same Tuesday, 4-1, overcast and chilly here in West New York, rain in the p.m., moon in conjunction with Jupiter and Uranus, U.S. to reduce B-52 raids, LilyVac just seems to feed in this headline information when it's pausing. Gas explosions, seal Mexican coal mines, 145 feared dead, Eisenhower train goes to Abilene, China convenes 9th National Congress, cultural revolution accomplished, second revolution waiting to be reset. Happy birthday, Wallace Beery, Chancellor Bismarck, Lon Chaney, Sergei Rachmaninoff, Debbie Reynolds. Full of that weary exultation which only true revolutionary lovers can reset, Merope and I toasted that moment with cordials of apricot nectar and pushed the printout button for the first trial draft of the revolutionary novel, Notes. A 1 and a 2 give us an N, give us an O. No, no. What's this? A 1 and a 14 and a 1 and a 7 and an 18 and a 1 and a 13, 12, 5, 1, 6, 25, et cetera, exclamation point, e.g., no novel, no notes, but a swarm of numbers, exclamation point. Merope and I looked into each other's reset, on and on, 13, 1, 18, 7, 1, 12, 5, 6, 1, 25, then a string of 55s and 49s alternating page after page after reset, not got all the chinks out of the ointment, 17 rules for the use of the comma, etc., push, 17 rules for the use of the comma, etc., push, punct. Point? No. Stop? No. Yes. Yes. And yes, and etc. Okay. Words cannot describe our dismay, sir. Faithful Merope's and mine. That's better. Numbers! Scrambled integers, not even binary. I was still weak. Last summer's gassing, the interruptions of my winter's rest. The printout went on, reams and quires of single and double digits. I stood by numb, rudderless, like a ship whose T has been crossed. At midnight, Lilivac tapped out a string of 26s and fell silent. Dialogue. Maybe doomsday's early this year, said Merope, and led me to bed. That was Tuesday. Thursday 4-3 was Maundy Thursday, also Nisan 15 and first night of Passover. Description. The sky cleared over Lake Casadega. The air was mild along the Niagara frontier. As we took my constitutional about the grounds of Lilydale, where a few early spiritualists raked their yards and spruced their cottages for the coming season, we could see clearly atop the hills on the farther shore the low buildings of the Pope John 23rd retreat. At Merope's direction, and to distract me from my gloom, that great pile of printout lay still untouched at Lilivac's feet. We vowed to put all numbers out of our head, out of our minds, until the Friday, just as Lilivac avoids all references to, whether by deletion or by artful substitution, e.g., bean, B-E-A-N, for bean, B-E-A-N. We had searched and destroyed on the Wednesday night all leavened bread in our cottage against the 7 days to come. Now towards sunset, this is the Passover ceremony, as you know. Now towards sunset, Merope arranged upon the Seder tray the seven symbols, matzah, baked egg, lamb's bone, haroseth, carpus, hazoreth, and bitter herb. She lit the two candles. She filled the two wine cups. She bid me begin the 15 stages of the service. We drank our 4 cups of wine. We asked and answered the 4 questions. We recited the story of the 70-year bondage of the Israelites, discussed the 10 plagues, and Rabbi Judah's coding them by their initials, BFL, BMB, HLDF. That is the names of the plagues, if you've ever read a Haggadah. And it comes out through Lilivac as blood, frogs, larks. Imagine a plague of larks. Beasts, murrin, boils, hail, lilies. I would love a plague of lilies, wouldn't you? Lilies, darkness, and firstborn slaying. We sang the 14 verses of Die New and the 10 of An Only Kid. We remarked upon the reckoning of climacteric years in the Hebrew calendar, also its designation of sabbatical and jubilee years, the 7 days of Levitical purifications and of the 3 major Jewish feasts, the 7 weeks between the first and second of the latter, the 7 years of Nebuchadnezzar's beasthood and Jacob's service with each of his wives. We were reminded of the Hebrew tradition that the seventh son of a seventh son has a special destiny, that God is called by 7 names and created creation in 7 days, that Solomon had 700 wives and 7 seals, his temple 7 pillars, that Samson's wedding feast lasted 7 days, on the 7th of which he told Delilah the secret of his strength, whereupon she bound him with 7 wives and shore him of 7 locks of hair, that Salome danced with 7 veils, and that Mary Magdalene was exorcised of 7 devils. Dialogue. Never mind the Goyisha stuff, Merope protested. Before I could mention the 7 deadly sins and cardinal virtues and gifts of the Holy Ghost and champions of Christendom and years of their ordeals and joys of Mary and sorrows of reset and sayings on the cross and holy angels and churches of Asia and parts of the Lord's Prayer, also the candlestick, stars, trumpets, spirits, horns, vials, plagues, monster heads, and lamb eyes in the book of Revelation. Back to the Hebes, then, that their very verb to swear means to come under the influence of 7 things, and that the Torah itself, according to one Kabbalistical tradition, had been a Heptateuch before it was a Pentateuch, one of its books having disappeared entirely, and another shrunk to 2 verses, Numbers 35 and 36, in the 10th chapter of the book of Numbers. Dialogue. Next year in Jerusalem, you know, said Merope, that reminds me of Lilivac's printout. Oh, all those numbers. Ah, Remember back in year O, she said, 1967-68, when we programmed Lilivac 2 with Thompson's motif index to folk literature, plus the fiction stacks of Lilydale's Marion Skidmore Library, plus master plots, plus monarch notes, and like that? Yes. Plus everything we could think of that comes in five, such as the fingers, toes, senses, and wits of Homo sapiens, the feet of pentametric verse and of Dr. Eliot's shelf of classics, the tones of pentatonic music, the great books and blessings of China, the bloods of Ireland, the original nations of the noble Iroquois, the divisions of the British Empire, the books of the Pentateuch, the weekdays of the week, the vowels of the alphabet, the ages of man, the months of Odysseus' last voyage as retold by Dante, the stories framed by Scheherazade's Tales of the Porter and Three Ladies of Baghdad, inasmuch as novel is a five-letter word, and our plan is a five-year plan? Yes. Well, remember back there in all that fiction, a tale by E.A. Poe called The Gold Bird, 1843, in which William LeGrand finds a message spelled out in numbers and deciphers it, starting from the hypothesis that if the numbers stand for letters and the coded message is in English, then the most frequently occurring number probably stands for the fifth letter of our alphabet, E, etc., and he drops the bird through the eye of a skull that he finds on the seventh limb of a tree, I forget why, and it leads him to Captain Kidd's treasure, I forget how? Gee whiz, Merrippy, are you suggesting dot, dot, dot? Yeah, well, we Jews, you see, are Hebrew, and our alphabet, like the Greek, served in olden times for counting as well as spelling out words. So when an old-time Jew looked at Hebrew words on a page, he also saw a string of numbers. So it's not surprising that among the mystical traditions associated with the books of the Kabbalah is the tradition of gematria, the manipulation of the numerical equivalents of the letters, etc. Hum, I expostulated. By gosh, Merrippy, I believe that you have found the hidden matzah, the afikoman in the ointment, the nigger in the woodpile that is the key to the treasure. Narrative. That day we reclined no more. I pass over our night-long ardor in the workroom among those sheaves of numbers, every one of which, aha, was under 27, except the 55s and 50 and 49s, no problems there. 5-5 is the letters of our notes and the years of our plan, 4 from 9 is 5, right? E, our prime letter in the year to come. But it were too much to expect a one-to-one correspondence. 1-to-1 equals A to A, a mere tautology. We gave it a go anyhow. Why not run it through the old computer? The first dozen letters came out, Margana Ifael, forget it. Thus the Thursday. Next Friday, 4-4. Good Friday for the Christians, day of Adam's creation for the Mohammedans, second of Pesach for Merope and three of her young friends who now swarmed in from their colleges and communes, Canada to reduce NATO forces, looting and rioting in Chicago after ML King memorial service, happy birthday Pierre Montu and Maurice Vlaminck, doomsday reset. Understandably, those friends, Merope's friends, did not at first quite trust me, despite Merope's assuring them that under my cape I was not the creepy wisp I might appear, but a sort of third worlder plus a bona fide second revolutionary, 3 plus 2 equals etc. dialogue. Come off it. Narrative. But I was patient and altogether too preoccupied with the search for a base 5 key to the cipher to share my Merope's distress at their youthful jibes. 5-5-5-5-5. I suggested to Lilivac that the key to those numbers was that number. At 6:13 p.m. PST, 9:13 at our meridian, we gathered round for the first 5 trial translation of the notes numbers into letters, i.e., 1 equals A, 2 equals A, 3 equals A, etc. I held Merope by the fingers of her hand. Rodriguez from CCNY held her other hand. On my right, Black Thelma and her lover Irving from Fort Erie smoked cannabis. 1. Margana Ifael, then nonsense. 2. Ditto. Also 3, 4, 5. Fui, said Merope. Order of frequency, then. 1 equals E, 2 equals T, etc. Morgana Ifael plus nonsense. Sheesh, said Merope. It is written in the Zohar, offered Rodriguez, that just as the initial letter Aleph is the male principle and proclaims the unity of G-D, so the second letter Bet is female. Together they postulate the alphabet, Alpha plus Beta, get it? But B is the instrument of creation, the mother of letters and of the world, amen. Wow, said Merope, let's try that one, Jerry. Well, okay, here goes. Plus nonsense. Elsewhere in the Zohar, vouchsafe Thelma, or is it in the Sefer Yetzirah? It say how Yud, the first letter of the Tetragrammaton, be to father, hey to mother, vow W to son, and the second hey the daughter. Also how Yezud be the sacred phallus, and Zion the sacred yoni. Try them ones. Well, okay, here goes. Morgana Ifael. Your turn, Irv. I'm a Catholic myself, confessed Irving, but Mr. Horner over at the remobilization farm, who sends his regards, showed me an old-time horn book in which was written, A-E-I-O-U, his great name doth spell. Here it is known, but is not known in hell. Play that on your calliope. Morgana E. Reset. Morgana E. Who? Inquired Rodriguez. You're cute, you are, Merope volunteered. They chatted on, those four, of other traditions from the Kabbalah, explaining to Irv that the letters of the Hebrew alphabet had originally refused to submit to the spelling out of a Torah which dealt in commandments and prohibitions, that just as the primordial universe of the Greeks was a chaos of atoms, which later formed themselves into the cosmos, so the primordial Torah was a jumble of letters which arranged themselves into words and sentences only as the events they set forth came to pass, that at the diaspora the letters of the holy name were separated, male from female, like Yahweh from the Shekinah. Matthew Arnold somewhere remarks, rejoined Irv, that God puts a heap of letters into each man's hand for him to make what word he will. They went out then to stroll in the balmy PM, leaving me alone with my scrambled notes, as Maimonides affirms that the Holy One, blessed be he, before creation was alone with the letters of his name. Holy Saturday! Moon in conjunction with Neptune, 4-5, Nixon intensifies secret Viet negotiations, anti-war march in NYC, 25 million Chinese being sent to farms from cities, man goes berserk on PA turnpike, kills 3 plus self, Dante plus Virgil finish descent through hell, happy birthday Catherine the First, Betty Davis, Thomas Hobbes. Thelma, Irving, and Rodriguez planned to spend the weekend secretly filling the water coolers in the Buffalo offices of certain large industrial corporations with polluted Lake Erie water. They urged Morgana to leave me behind to crank out more mishmash with my big dumb toy and come with them. She hesitated loyally a moment before saying yes. Dialogue. What's this Morgana? She inquired. Why, chortled Thelma, it be short for Morgana Le Fay, like Lily Vac say. Oi, ejaculated Rodriguez. Tut and fee, suggested Merope. If I am Morgana Le Fay, then Jerome is Merlin. Arthur, Arthur, teased Rodriguez. I urged them, if they craved a holiday from the serious work of finding the key that will turn Lily Vac's numbers into revolutionary letters, to devote their youthful energies while in Buffalo to the neutralization of that author who counterfeits me, just as the wily Schizora unicornis larva mimes, not the flawless hickory leaf, never found in fact, but flawlessly the flawed and bitten truth of real hickory leaves. What in the name of crucified Christ is he talking about? Cheerfully interrogated Irving. You ask me, Thelma say, he out of his motherfucking carton. I propose Rodriguez, that we leave him alone with his jumbled letters as Maimonides maintains that Yahweh reset. Merope smartly reminded them that I had fought the good fight against DDT and was still to some degree a casualty of that battle, hence my twitches, but it was her conviction that each must make the revolution in his own way. Don't bog thy neighbor, et cet. She kissed me goodbye on the cheek and said, dig you later, pops, don't forget to feed the goats, ta-ta, and And Irving Josh, feed him the numbers, man. And Thelma E. Nance, some eats them, some plays them, hee hee. Home. Off they went in my faithful VW blank, leaving me alone with my reset. They were gone 2 weeks, I began to wonder. Dante climbed Mount Purgatory and ascended to the earthly paradise. Jesus rose from the dead. Cain was born. Abel slain. Passover ended. Napoleon abdicated. Lincoln was shot. The Titanic sank. Sirhan reset. I tried key after ditto after same. Marganai Fael, where was my Merope? Despair, Comrade Mac. When on the 19th they returned after all to Lilydale to celebrate the 194th anniversary of the first American Revolution, i.e. the skirmish at the Old North Bridge, snow on the ground, Black Seas Cornell Student Union, happy 36th Jane Mansfield, I tearfully embraced my Merope's proffered cheek and declared dialogue. My dear, our scrambled notes are turned to stone. Whew, exclaimed Thelma, we stone too. Geez, marveled Irving, he really is still at it. There's something I must tell you, Jerome, declared Merope. Cool it, Marge, suggested Rodriguez. He'll learn it himself soon enough. Did you bring me a surprise? I inquired of that smiling, youthful foursome. Sort of, teased Irving. Like we checked that hornbook business up at the farm, see? And this cat, Morgan, that's up there these days, it's got all kinds of smarts. He told us how A-E-I-O-U is an anagram for I-E-O-U-A, dig? Which is a sort of non-consonantal counterpart, if you follow me, to the vowelless tetragrammaton Yahweh, a.k.a. Jehovah, get it. It was further suggested by one Monsieur Castine up there, added Rodriguez, who I might add has got a proper Yiddish akuf on his shoulders if I ever saw one, that the so-called Faithful Shepherd Book of the Zohar declares, not as I am written am I read. Castine feels this to be an allusion to the Kabbalistical practices of Notarikon and Timura, which with the aforementioned Gematria comprise the three principal approaches of the Kabbalist to scripture regarded as cipher. Gematria, you will recall, is the search for meaning in the numerical values of the letters. Thus, Margana, for example, has a value of 55, and Lefay, a.k.a. Ifael, 49. Thus far, Castine, with whom we young four agree, that Notarikon is unlikely to be of help to you. It consists of regarding the letters of a word as an acrostic for a sentence, or vice versa. Margana Ifael and the rest not being words, no acrostic can be legitimately extracted, and to regard that whole printout as itself the acrostic for a much larger text, that were madness. No, no, it strikes us that Timura, which is to say anagrammatical transposition, is the key to the treasure, Jerome, old sport, a key first hit upon serendipitously by good Thelma here when she turned Ifael into Lefay and echoed by your scrambling of notes into stone. What you have here, friend, what your lilyvac hath wrought, this is the longest telegraph joke in literature, I guess, is a leafy anagram of monstrous proportions beside which the runes scribbled on the Sibyl's oak leaves and scattered by the wind in Virgil's Aeneid were no tougher an acorn to crack than the Sunday crossword. To it, old man, to it. Steer terse reset through that dense foliage till that thou comest to the golden bough or flawless hickory leaf, never found in nature but reset. Only grasp it and reset. Meanwhile, we got other fish to fry. Unfinished business, as it were, ha ha. Margana, too. How are you going to keep a chick down in Paris after she's seen that farm? We off to Chautauqua where the action is. End monologue, dialogue. Thus crumbleth the cookie, Jer, said Merope Margana tenderly. Each must revolt in his, her own reset. I'll stop by, Debeth and Quando, to do a leaf or two with you. Cookie be the word, say Thelma, he done flip his. St. Elric smile upon you, Irving intoned, and upon your leafy anagram, amen, bye. exposition, complication, climax, denouement. Comrade Mac, we're ready. That was 3 weeks, 3 days ago. Since then, daylight saving time has begun. De Gaulle has lost his referendum and retired. The bounty crew has mutinied. General Proctor and Tecumseh have besieged Fort Meigs. Mayday, mayday. Louis XVII has been restored to the throne of France. Napoleon has given out the fiction of his death on St. Helena. Vive le reset. And Lillivac and I vouchsafe this astonishing illumination from comrades Rodriguez, Thelma, and Irving, blessed and inspired by Merope Margana, who drops us the odd wish you were here from Chautauqua Institution or the remobilization farm, where she is making the revolution in her own reset. Alone here with the letters of my amen, I have found the treasure, I have found the lock. Nothing is wanting save the key for Lillivac's unscrambling of the leafy anagram. And while such funding is available to me from many sources, the voice of history tells me to reset. This is the final battle. On Wisconsin, off the pigs, hail to the chief. Oh, say, can you see any bird birds on me? Today is Tuesday, the 13th. Jamestown founded. U.S. declares war on Mexico. Riots at SUNY Stony Brook. Arson at Brooklyn College. Nixon urges draft reform. Sunny and mild here in Lilydale, then cloudy and showers. We are floating like a butter fat, stinging like a key to the reset. Complimentary clothes. Hold on just a mothering minute. A modest supplementary grant, comrade, from the Tidewater Foundation, or perhaps from the legacy of His Majesty your father, if his will has been done, would surely do to work the last remaining monkey wrenches out of the ointment of this flawed leafy reset. Next thing we know, it'll write in longhand, even fill in the blanks in its own armor like a simile. Having a wonderful time. Wish you were reset. 10-2-2. Thank you. Good night.